So I'm actually new for on AMHSA's board. I am the Race, Ethnicity, and Culture and Health Action Committee Advocacy Coordinator. And with everything going on in today's climate, I really brought attention to like, okay, we need to have this conversation. So AMHSA allowed me to set this platform, and I thought about what physicians would I want to speak about this issue, and I looked to see who I was following on Twitter, and I found my favorites, and I would not do justice introducing them, so I'm going to let all panelists introduce themselves. So we can start with anyone.
I'll go ahead and get started. I'm Aja Endome. I am a neurosurgeon scientist currently in Bethesda. I'm also one of the co-founders of Physicians for Criminal Justice Reform. I was an AMHSA member way back in the day, got my free netter, was able to attend one of the national meetings. Really happy to be here and discuss all of this with you. Obviously, racial inequities go through all specialties, including treatment of brain tumors, which is one of the things that I work on. And really excited to engage with you all and answer any questions that you might have.
I'll go next. I'm Dr. Leanne Webb. I'm an emergency physician. I'm on faculty at University of Virginia, which is in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I just jumped in next because I'm not going to go after my colleague Tyson Bell, who's on this call. So I went to med school at University of Virginia and then did emergency medicine at University of Chicago. And since then, I've really worked all over the country, including Chicago, North Carolina, Baltimore, New York City, and now back to Virginia. So I've been able to see the breadth of both urban and non-urban patient populations in emergency medicine. I love emergency medicine because I have the ability to treat anyone and everyone who walks through the door. And I do take into consideration, like I try to practice value-based care, and I do take that into consideration, but I also have the luxury of not worrying upfront what my patients need to pay when they come to see me. So that's really nice. So I work in the emergency department. I also am the founder of the Get Well Company, which I mostly run my consulting and community efforts through. That we've been doing a lot of community efforts. We can talk a little bit about sort of advocacy and actions. We've written a COVID-19 children's book and some other community education outreach initiatives, and I'm the senior medical affairs consultant for a biotech firm called Rubix LS. I did go to business school, finished that up last year, got my MBA, so happy also to talk to anyone offline about that as well.
I can go next. My name is Tyson Bell. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Virginia. I've known Leanne since high school, and we go a long way back. And I've also worked with Eja at the NIH as a critical care fellow. One of the first years you're on faculty, I believe. My background, I went to University of Virginia for undergrad, Columbia for medical school, and then the Mass General Hospital for my internal medicine infectious disease fellowship. And then went to the NIH for critical care fellowship and came on the faculty at UVA in 2017, where I work in both critical care and infectious disease, mostly in a medical ICU where I'm the director. I'm also the founder of a biotech called Outpeak Labs with the aim of bringing a in-home screening solution for colon cancer. I'm then involved in a few quality initiatives around the hospital, namely around mortality and sepsis treatment and prevention. Linking together our data infrastructure so that we can make good decisions, and proud to be a part of a coalition of friends and colleagues who are pushing forward for racial justice in healthcare.
And Dr. Fitzhugh, you're last.
And I am used to being last because all these WebExes we have now, everybody's names are in alphabetical order, and since I'm a V, I am always last, so it's cool. My name is Dr. Valerie Fitzhugh. I am an associate professor of pathology at both Rutgers New Jersey Medical School and Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. I actually went to Rutgers for undergrad, went to New Jersey Medical School for my medical school training, where I was also an AMHSA member. And then I started my residency at Albany Medical Center and Albany Medical College, went back to New Jersey Medical School to finish up, and then did my fellowship in cytopathology at Mount Sinai in Manhattan. I am practicing as a bone and soft tissue pathologist at New Jersey Medical School, but I'm also now in my new role serving as interim chair of pathology, both at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson and NJMS. And I am the first Black woman to ever serve in the role of chair at New Jersey Medical School. And I am the third to serve at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson. I'm also the third Black woman to serve as a chair of pathology ever, so in an academic setting. So it's been a very, very busy last few months. I started that role in March 2020, just before COVID. So 2 weeks before COVID got bad in New Jersey, I took on interim chair. So that was just fantastic. I'm very passionate about the pipeline in pathology. We are a specialty that has very few underrepresented minorities. In terms of Black practicing pathologists, we're actually only 2% of the entire pathologist pool. So I'm usually not surprised when I meet an applicant who's told me that they've never met a Black pathologist in academia, because there are just so few of us. So one of my passions is the pipeline, getting underrepresented minorities interested in academic medicine, and getting students to see that academic medicine is a good place to be. So those are things I'm passionate about. And I guess to dispel a couple of pathologist stereotypes, I don't like autopsies, and I really, really like people, despite what people think about pathologists. So I'll stop there.
So in case anyone is wondering, our topics today are going to cover the experience of being a physician of color and any patient bias that are currently happening in medicine. So I'm going to go ahead and get started with our first question. So the CDC refers to health inequities and health disparities interchangeably as types of unfair health differences closely linked with social, economic, and environmental disadvantages that adversely affects groups of people. So my first question would be, what are the current challenges to address healthcare disparities in communities of color?
Big question. I'm going to address it from two different directions, personally, from my practice and the advocacy that I'm involved in. So when you look at social determinants of health, obviously, that's a big, big part of what we're dealing with here. My organization, Physicians for Criminal Justice Reform, looks at one narrow slice of that, and that's to look at negative interactions with the criminal justice system and how those can impact health for people in communities. And there's a myriad of ways that can happen, whether that's from the lack of mental health care that people can receive, maltreatment of substance abuse disorders, where people can be imprisoned instead of offered treatment. That can be the poor care that people might experience when they're incarcerated themselves, or the lack of availability of care if they're coming out of an incarcerated situation. The economic effects on neighborhoods when they're over policed. One thing we've been talking about a lot around police brutality and the constant bombardment of videos and things that we're all exposed to on a routine basis. And you can easily picture yourself falling asleep in a Wendy's after a birthday party and ending up in a bad conversation, and saw what happened there, where you could see yourself inadvertently, whether you did or did not use a fake 20, handing that over to a clerk and going back to your car and minding your own business, and ending up in an altercation because of an accusation who's never proven and essentially given a death sentence. And that stress, as we all know, that ever-present stress, that increase in cortisol, is going to affect everything that happens to you health-wise from then on out. So, in medical school, I can't say that I had a whole lot of conversations about what was going on, with police or outside in the community, or the stressors that we have, what the interplays would be. I like to think that med schools might have moved forward from that. But it's hard to separate, what happens to a patient individually from what's going on in the community. Then if I put on my other hat as a neurosurgeon scientist, and then you look at how, people of color are often not offered clinical trials in the first place, or maybe don't seek them out because of longstanding distrust of the scientific community. In many cases, they might miss out on the best new treatments that are coming down the pipe. In my current practice setting, I don't get to see as many people of color as you might expect being in Bethesda right by DC. And that's a shame. So I'll stop there. I know there's a lot to say on this topic, but you know, there are several different angles you could look at racial disparities as a practicing physician.
One thing I wanted to add to the point about mistrust is that the trust between a physician and a patient is one of the most fundamental relationships to making a patient better. And one of the points that I make with my students and residents and fellows who are talking about patients who are being the keywords, not compliant, not going along with the plan, distrustworthy, we have to understand that that is an earned mistrust. The U.S. healthcare system has worked extremely hard to gain the mistrust of the African-American community. And going back to experimentations, the Tuskegee experiment, stealing Henrietta Lacks' body tissue, grave diggers in the Civil War era to inform medical students on anatomy. So the list just goes on and on and on. And these stories are known in a Black community. And if it's not acknowledged and not approached with the right tact, then it is hard to bridge that gap sometimes. And if you further introduce unconscious bias into the situation, patients know that there is sometimes unequal care given according to race and ethnicity. That makes it that much more challenging. So I would highlight that as one of the challenges in delivering care in the community. A second is accurate data collection. And this was one of the efforts that Dr. Webb, along with some other colleagues, spearheaded to call on the CDC, WHO, and other public health entities to actually release data on the health disparities in COVID, a pandemic that was ravaging the country and continues to cause many, many problems. But you know, you're not going to find a problem that you're not looking for. So if you're not doing accurate data collection and finding out who our patients are and where our disparities are, then you're never going to be able to find a solution. I saw an MMWR from the CDC back in the 1990s that pointed to the need to more accurately reflect race and ethnicity in data collection. And by the time we get to COVID, that percentage of data collection that they were reporting out was actually worse than what they identified as the problem in 1994. So not having that accurate data is just puts you two steps back when it comes to trying to figure out how to solve problems. And then the third, I would say, is the nature of racism as it exists in the United States today. You know, when we think of racism, you know, classically, we think of, you know, active racism, Ku Klux Klan, Knight Riders, lynchings, and the things that kind of populate our textbooks. Racism now, in more or less in its form, is structural and baked into society. That means that it is the default to have inequities in how people live, wealth inequality, education inequality, job discrimination, housing discrimination, and these all translate to health outcomes. And what it means is that if it's a default and you do nothing about it and aren't actively thinking about it, then those problems are going to perpetuate and be ongoing. And that's the way it's designed at this point. So in order to actually combat systemic racism in healthcare and in society in general, you have to take an active, proactive approach to finding where these issues are, talking about them, being open about them, developing a comfort level with speaking about it, and then, you know, developing action plans in order to formulate corrective action. And that's something that our country has just not gotten to the point at. I'm happy to see that our collective conscience seems to be rising. And I just hope that we can take advantage of this moment and actually flip the script and actually, develop a working language around talking about health disparities and racism.
Thank you, Dr. Bell.
I was just going to add that it's a big question. It's a really big question. We could literally have a week-long conference about the question that you just asked. But so it's a really big question because it's a really big problem, mm-hmm. and we all recognize that. And it's been a problem for a long time. And for those of us who have been doing this for a while and who especially have been in academics, I'm not like a core researcher, but certainly have been following the research for quite some time. Like, health disparities have been there for a long time. And as Tyson said, we're not seeing many gains over the years of health disparities, right? So as much as we are asking for equity and preaching equity and advocating for equity, like the research, it looks very similar to when I first started in medical school. So maybe, yeah, we gained some from, you know, since the Civil War, right, when they had the Freedmen's Bureau Medical Division that was taking care of Black people, and it was fully, you know, sort of under-sourced. But we are not in a place where we can claim success. Like, we have not eliminated health disparities. There's a really long way to go. And of course, during this COVID-19 pandemic, everything is amplified for everyone. It has fully exposed the faults, right? So the people who have been doing this for a long time and who've been seeing this and who have been living this, and our families have been living this for a long time, like, it was no surprise whatsoever that COVID hit Black America specifically and other communities of color like it did, like, because we know, because we see it every day, right? And so we talk about the social determinants of health, and there are many, many, many social determinants of health. Again, that could be its entire hour-long lecture or more. But, you know, with COVID, we see things like hypertension, lung disease, diabetes, obesity. We see all those things, but you can't talk about like obesity and hypertension and diabetes without talking about food deserts, which is a social determinant of health. And you can't talk about things like socioeconomic status without talking about redlining, right? It was redlining that happened in the 1930s, and how people, those communities were disinvested. Like, the people were actively encouraged not to invest in those communities. People could not get loans to buy their own homes in those communities, then, because that's how you build wealth, right? And you can't talk about like our kids with higher rates of asthma and lung disease without talking about people just coming into these communities with these industries that are polluting the air and landfills, and it's something that keeps happening over and over again. You know, in Cumberland County, which is in Virginia, is near us, we just a few months ago had to advocate to not have a landfill in like a predominantly African American community. I can't even take the trash out the day before in my neighborhood. I can't put the trash can out without like someone in the HOA complaining about it. But now you're talking about putting an entire landfill in a community, literally. So, you know, we see this, you know, Tyson referred to it as structural racism or systemic racism. So it has really pervaded our culture. Those are the social determinants of health that we're talking about. We haven't even gotten to access to care, and there are many different forms of access. And maybe once you do access care, are you getting the same type of care? Is your provider, you know, does your provider have implicit bias or overt racism? Because that exists with providers too. I have seen it myself. And so, you know, all of these things, we study all of these things separately and together, but we kind of talk about them separately a little bit, but they're all like intermixed in real life, and it is kind of hard to separate them out. So lots of people are doing good work, and it's a big problem, big question, big problem. And hopefully we can get to a little bit in this conversation talking about some solutions as well.
Okay. I would like to move on to the second question. Dr. Fitzhughes, can you tell me what has been your experience with stereotypes while wearing your white coat? If you had experienced any stereotypes, did you reach out for help? Did you find support from your institution? And what do you do when you are confronted with a colleague who is racist?
Oh, a lot to unpackage there. You know, I'll start with a story first, because people always remember stories. And this is something I shared on Twitter in the Black in the Ivory hashtag. And it's something that if you follow Twitter, I would invite you to look at the stories of the academics who have had the courage to share, because it's really interesting, you know, what people have gone through. If anything, it gave me some sad comfort that at least I wasn't alone. But my story. So this is probably 5 or 6 years ago. You know, I was, and again, as I started out saying, I hate autopsies. But being in an academic institution, every once in a while, I get stuck doing one. And when I do them with my residents, of course, you know, I'm down there, I'm in the morgue with them, teaching them, you know, showing them all these different kinds of things. So for whatever reason, that particular day, instead of taking the back stairs out of the department down to the morgue, which would have been the fast way to go, but I was needing some steps, I decided to take the long walk to the morgue. And as I was getting toward the elevators just around the corner from my department, a white lady came up to me with a bag of her empty Burger King and said, "Can you put this in the trash for me?" And I'm wearing scrubs, ID on, like, our janitorial staff does not wear scrubs. There was no question that I was a physician in the hospital. And I mean, and badge blazing, the MD showing, and I literally just said, yeah, the trash bin's over there. And I just got on the elevator and kept my day moving. The issue, so of course I was alone, so there was really no colleague who was there to help me in that moment. But it was just like, I'm looking at this woman like, you've got to be kidding me, right? Like, you see what I'm wearing, you see how I'm dressed. I mean, I can't even say, I work in the hospital that I went to medical school, that I trained in medical school. And how many times I've been stopped by security in my white coat, where's your ID? Versus colleagues of mine walking right past them to get onto the elevator. So it's like, you know, that people do see us differently. You know, I'm fortunate because at New Jersey Medical School, we talk a lot about diversity. We just had a big diversity panel last week, you know, in the wake of what happened to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. You know, we started having these difficult conversations because we need to be doing more, and we know we need to be doing more. So my institution seems to be invested in really helping colleagues of color be able to have that safe space and to find their voice. In terms of racist colleagues, I think that depends on your level. It's much easier for me at the associate professor level, who's been a decade plus out, to be able to say, let me tell you what you said, that wasn't cool. I wouldn't have even been able to do that 5 years ago. And as a medical student, that puts you in a really uncomfortable place because you're looking at these people for letters of recommendation. You're looking at these people, you know, who are going to control where you might match for residency, you know, where you may go on to in life. So as a student, it's much harder to speak up and find your voice in those situations. You know, can you attempt to have that one-on-one as a student? You can attempt it, but I think it's very, very difficult. You know, as a faculty member, I've had to have those conversations with people where I pull them, and I try not to embarrass folks in a meeting. As much as I want to check somebody in a meeting, I try not to do it. I'll just pull them aside after and I say, let me discuss with you what you said. Let me tell you how that was perceived by me as a person of color, because like, I'm the only Black person in my department at either school. So it's not like there are other people for me to bounce these things off of. So I'll say, you know, let's just take 5 minutes and talk about that. I think that's really, really important. And that's something that on the faculty level I can do, and I can do much more, I shouldn't say much more safely. I mean, I guess a little more safely, because I'm in a place where, you know, I've done the things I need to do. And if I decided tomorrow to go open a daycare and do that instead, I could. But I think on the student level, that's it's very, very difficult to combat it at a higher level. Now, I will say amongst each other, if you hear other students, you know, speaking that way, and you hear other students, you know, putting down communities of color, then you absolutely should say something, because those are the people who are going to be taking care of your families, my family, me, as I get older. And I don't want to have to go to a doctor who I know is going to look at me and, you know, and think, okay, well, she's a little bit heavy, she must be eating at McDonald's every day, when that's actually not the case at all. It has nothing to do with where I'm eating or what I'm eating. You know, my issues are my issues, but to assume that a patient is a certain thing because of how they look will get you into a world of trouble. So yes, speak amongst each other, definitely speak up. You know, there seems to be a trend these days of people putting this stuff on full blast, like on Facebook and things. And I don't know if you want to go that route to embarrass your colleagues, but I do think that these difficult conversations between students are going to become crucially important, as you will be the providers for the future.
I don't like to embarrass people, but oftentimes I get people to embarrass themselves. And that's kind of the best way to go about it. So I use appreciative inquiry. So appreciative inquiry is not made for talking about racism or getting people to embarrass themselves or whatever you want to think about it. But I'm very curious. And so I hear things, and while I'm in the meeting, because I did, Dr. Fitzhugh, what you've done, I did that for a number of years, and I found that like things don't change. And in fact, people can get very defensive, even in those like one-on-one conversations. Certainly not as much as if you embarrass them. I have learned that lesson. But if you're just curious, so I will stop and say, what do you mean when you say that? And I will make people clarify or encourage them to clarify what they mean on the spot in a meeting. And if I think they didn't dig deep enough, I'm like, oh, well, what do you mean by this? And what do you mean by this? And it kind of goes down the rabbit hole. And then suddenly they're just like, and then everyone's kind of like, this is awkward. And then the conversation moves on. And then sometimes that person actually will come to me after the meeting and say, like, you know, this is this is how I feel about it, and we might have a conversation. And I find that that is way more productive to get them to back themselves into a corner than me calling them out. I'm an assistant professor, so maybe that's part of it too, because I don't pull as much weight as like the associate professors or the, you know, certainly like the leadership, people in leadership positions. But I do like using appreciative inquiry. I agree. I think it's really hard as a medical student to navigate this successfully, even with anonymous, even in areas where you have like anonymous ways to air your grievances. I think it's very hard because a lot of these situations are very specific. So as soon as you report it, even if it's anonymous, that person knows who you are and there's some retribution at some point. And so, you know, everyone says, oh, medical students can speak up about everything, but they can't speak about up about sensitive things. Well, it's because you probably are, like, you have a legitimate reason because there's some retribution of some sort. And so I try to advocate on behalf of medical students, particularly when there's someone who is known to be problematic. That doesn't happen a ton. I think my colleagues at University of Virginia are actually like pretty good, but I see it happen more with residents than I do with attendings, at least where I work. And I try to be an advocate on behalf of the students.
I don't have much to add to that, but I can say that when I was a medical student, I was also in a similar position, and I observed but didn't call things out because you're in a very different position. But man, when I became an attending, I can talk about these things all the time. And I make a point on my rounds to point out things like microaggressions and interactions and sexism, racism. We talked about Juneteenth last year on Mickey Rounds on June 19th. So I can introduce and have the platform that I can use to talk about these issues. There was actually one day in my ICU where there are two patients side by side. They were both men. They were both in their late 30s. They were both acutely agitated for almost the same cause. One had an underlying TBI and another one had, I think, had a history of seizures. One of them was Black, one of them was white, and one of them had psych called and security called and meds administered, and the other person was reassured and had a sitter and kind of ease out of their acutely agitated state. And you could probably guess which patient had the security come in and rough them up. It was my second week working at UVA, so as an attending. And after we rounded on, I actually had the white patient, the Black patient was on the other side. I asked my team, now what factors do you think went into two patients with the exact same problem being treated very differently? And there's a lot of silence, but I've learned to be comfortable with that silence and let it fester a little bit so that people can be uncomfortable and create that tension. And then I later stepped into that tension and said, you know, this is a form of unconscious bias, and it's something that we're not going to notice if we don't speak about it or mention it, certainly if we're not looking for it. But this is something that we have to be mindful of as we're trying to provide care, that we could provide different care to a person just based on how they look and what we perceive about them. So it's very interesting having the ability to sort of point these things out. And how I handle that's some, I think every Black physician has a mistaken for transport or anyone else other than a physician. Mine was, I had a patient transferred in from an outside hospital, and I walked into the room, and the patient said, oh, are you going to take me now to CAT scan? And I said, actually, I'm the one who decided to fly you over here and ordered the CAT scan. I try not to get bogged down in all of these moments because some of them are just funny and other people's ignorance, and I got to move on with my day. But one of the things I learned to, and I didn't do this consciously, but I've noticed that when I go into patients' rooms, I enter, announce my name immediately in a loud voice, and I actually hold my badge out. I forgot to take it off. But this little thing right there, it was made so that patients who are hard of hear or can't see that well, can see that you're a doctor, and even has like a color code. And that's kind of been a saving grace for me because I enter the room, I say, I am Dr. Bell, hold my badge out. Everyone knows I'm a physician right off the bat. And I probably have saved a few patients that uncomfortable interaction where they would mistake me for transport. And I don't do it purposefully, but it's something that I've noticed I've done to like step into that space immediately so that I just don't have to deal with it. And, you know, everyone has their coping mechanisms, but, I would say before that, it probably happened on a weekly basis where I would be mistaken for someone other than a physician.
I will also say that it is usually a person of color who's speaking up at this level, at sort of the attending level as well. And what we really need is for like everyone to speak up when they hear things like that and call them out, not just amongst yourselves, but when you are an attending, like feel free to speak up. And it doesn't matter what color you are, what race you are, if you think that the patient is, there's a microaggression against the patient or against your colleagues, like speak up in whatever way that you feel is comfortable and safe for you.
I have another question. Dr. Bell, you brought up an interesting point with the difference in treatment. So my question for the panelists, why is there a medical culture to dismiss the pain of a Black patient?
I mean, sadly, I think a lot of it really is systemic racism, and a lot of it goes back to how Black people were experimented on, you know, during slavery, after slavery. You know, Dr. Webb brought up Tuskegee. You know, these are things that are rampant in culture, and it was seen as okay to do this to Black people. And, you know, unfortunately, depending on how you're raised and how you see different situations, you don't just grow out of that when you go to medical school unless somebody has that difficult conversation with you. So, you know, people look, I mean, and they've done surveys where they've asked people, you know, how do you perceive the pain tolerance in, you know, patient X versus patient Y? And for some reason, everyone seems to think that Black people can just take so much more pain. I can tell you, I've had two babies. I can't take any more pain than anybody else, okay? But that's the reality, is we're just seen as these strong people. And it's not just the poorest amongst us. The fact that Serena Williams can go in, have a baby, practically tell you, I am having another PE, and have people not believe her when she'd already had one. That's what we live with, and that's what we're working with. And I think a lot of it goes back to, unfortunately, to systemic racism and the fact that we're just not believed. And, you know, and I see now in the comments, again, the Tuskegee syphilis study, which was a big one. I mean, we've been seeing this in our culture from time immemorial, pretty much. And that's why we have so many issues when it comes to trust in our community of physicians. And the reality is there aren't enough Black physicians to see every Black person in the country. And that would be the same, I think, for most ethnic groups. So for those people who want to see someone of color who looks like them, knowing how low our numbers are in medicine, you know, across the board, that becomes an issue, especially when we get back to that issue of trust. So, you know, unfortunately, I mean, that's my take on it. I think a lot of it really is systemic racism and these ingrained opinions of what people of color are versus what we actually are and what we, you know, and how we actually feel. That would be my take.
I agree. And I see Tyson posted that link. That's a really good article to read. Good as in like it informs us, but it does talk about something that's very heavy, something that needs to be addressed. So like slave owners did justify slavery in the inhumane treatment of Black men and women in medical research. That is how they justified it, because if you said that someone is human and fully equal to you, like there's no way you're going to do that to them. And we see multiple instances of that throughout history. But, you know, the slaves were, I mean, so the end of the Civil War, we're talking right now a lot about like the monuments, right, that are coming down, particularly like the Robert E. Lee Monument, about an hour from us in Richmond, Virginia, is coming down. So the Civil War, or at least the beginning of the end of the Civil War, was April 9th, 1865, when Lee surrendered to Grant, right? It wasn't until a couple months later that slaves were actually freed. But when they were freed, they didn't have anywhere to go. So they didn't have a residence. They were essentially like living in crowded living conditions, old prisons, wherever they could find. And there were no organized hospitals to speak of, really, for almost anyone. But the white poor did have some privately funded hospitals. Black people were not allowed to be seen there. And then other people were getting private care by physicians in their homes, right? So they, you know, there was a crisis in healthcare, a public health crisis for Black people in that country. No one really cared about it, but the Freedmen's Bureau Medical Division was an undersourced kind of mess that was formed between 1865 and 1872. And that closed down when there was a little bit of progress. So both in slavery, where it's like, keep my slaves well enough to work for me so that I can have economic prosperity. And with the Freedmen's Bureau, the government's like, well, keep them well enough, but we don't really want to continue to fund, you know, the healthcare of Black people. We talk about like sort of the separate but equal segregated hospitals after the Freedmen's Bureau hospital shut down, and they weren't all separate and equal. There also weren't enough hospitals to treat all Black people. So some Black people ended up being treated literally in the basement of hospitals. My hospital and Tyson's hospital, where we work now at University of Virginia, is one of those hospitals. And there are still people alive to this day who remember being treated in the basement of our hospital. And those stories are told to their, you know, daughters and sons, and told to their daughters and sons and theirs. So this is an intergenerational thing too, both the mistrust of the Black community, not mistrust of the Black community, but mistrust of the medical profession in the Black community, as well as mistrust with trials, right? Like trials are experiments. This is deeply rooted in the fabric, is weaved into the fabric of our society. And at another study at our University of Virginia, which is actually where I went to medical school, like 50% of the students held at least one false belief against Black people. That was done in like 2016. So that was that black people didn't age the same as white people. Black people didn't have the same, like their nerve endings weren't as sensitive as white people, that our skin was thicker than white people's. And we see this playing out in the literature time and time again, that Black people's pain is not treated in the same way that white people's pain is, particularly in the emergency medicine literature, which is what I do. I work in the emergency department. People with sickle cell crisis are undertreated for pain. People who come in even for a fractured extremity, like an orthopedic injury, Black people are less likely to get pain medication compared to white people. And so this is a problem that we've seen for a very long time, and it's deeply rooted in racism and deeply rooted in slavery and the after effects of that.
My next question for you guys. In 2018, the Association of American Medical, they reported that among active physicians in our country, only 5% identify as being Black or African American, right? In that same year, only 3.6% of full-time U.S. medical faculty members were Black or African American. What outreach initiatives can be implemented to encourage a more diverse applicant pool and the involvement of underrepresented groups in medicine?
So this is one of my, we'll call it pet peeves, but something I'd like to talk about more recently. So the NIH in particular, it has a lot of pipeline programs. And so, you know, I think that pipeline programs are fantastic. And SNMA has MAPS, and pipeline programs are, you know, I think a lot of us might have participated in pipeline programs as we were coming through. And I enjoy speaking to high school students and undergrads and, you know, giving them the little tools and tricks that I have to hopefully help them make it through. But there's only so many of the students that are out there that can go through pipeline programs. And if I talk to a high school student today, it's going to take, you know, another 15 plus years for them to become a neurosurgeon. So the question I often ask departments and hospitals and, you know, academic departments is, well, what can you do right now? And turns out that your average neurosurgery department or medical school or faculty that's looking for people to employ could do something right now to increase their recruitment of diverse candidates. There are changes they could be making right now in how they evaluate faculty, how they promote faculty. I don't know what's going on with Dr. Bell, but I look and I see he's an assistant professor with all the things that he's doing. I'm like, how long is it going to take him to make associates? There's something going on there. I don't know. You know, if you looked at my NIH profile through last year, you'd see that I was something called a staff clinician. And if you looked at the stuff that I was doing, that might not line up with what I was providing in service to the institution. And then when other people of color see, well, you know, people don't seem to be advancing in academics, then maybe they decide to go out into private practice. And then there's less faculty in the medical schools to kind of bring people in and engage in the mentoring and stuff like that. And then the mentoring often doesn't show up in your promotion and tenure committee. So then you spend less time on that. You need to publish more. So maybe do a little bit less mentoring. So spend a little bit less time on that pipeline program because it's not valued. And the person that's really engaged in the pipeline program crashes out of academics, right? Medical school, same thing. It's, you know, if we're looking at strictly MCAT scores and, you know, the cost of taking these MCAT classes is astronomical. And, you know, people who have time to get tutored outside of school or take additional classes while they're in undergrad and make sure that they, you know, can boost up their resume. You know, there are different disparities that happen there. I know when I applied to the NIH as a high school student, as a college student, as a medical student, I never got in. Because I didn't know that the way the NIH worked to get into a lab is that you put the application in, but then you had to contact labs. And it really helped if you knew somebody who knew somebody at the lab who would tell them to look at your resume and get in. So there's a lot of kids, so people that work at the NIH who are working in labs at the NIH, maybe not their lab, maybe not their institute, but they get in. So disparities get propagated that way. So there are things that you could do in how you evaluate students, undergrad students who applied in the last round to apply to medical school. There were plenty, I assure you, of, you know, Black, Hispanic, you know, whatever underrepresented group you want, who wanted to get into medical school last year and didn't get in, right? What are we doing for those kids? What are we doing for the people graduating residency that want to stay in academics but don't get told about the job at the institution they want to work at because they have some under the table deal to already hire one of their residents or someone that they know, right? And how do we change that? How do we keep the faculty that are engaged in these pipeline programs and trying to recruit and mentor people who are not represented in medicine going forward? So I do think, you know, again, I'm not saying this to disparage the pipeline programs. I think the pipeline programs are important and they do build the base of people who will have the skills that people recognize right now. If you have time, there's a fantastic chapter written by Dr. Kimberly Griffin Haynes. She was a few years ahead of me at Stanford in undergrad, and she wrote a really fantastic and very long chapter on the recruitment intent and retention of faculty in academic departments and what's being done wrong. And really the overarching point to me was sometimes there's a problem with the ivory tower right now and what the ivory tower is looking at. It's not a problem with us. It's not a problem with the pipeline. It's not the problem with the people that are applying for these positions. It might be what the ivory tower has decided to value. And if the ivory tower is going to wait until everybody out there who looks like me, looks like the people already in the ivory tower as far as their CV and the resume and their qualifications, then we may never see equity. We may never see diversity in the ivory tower. And it may be that the ivory tower itself has to change what it values in order to bring a different type of person in.
I would also be remiss if I didn't address the culture of medicine and all of this, because I think that a lot of times our medical students have a hard time, and that's all medical students, with the culture of medicine, which can be malignant depending on where you go, but particularly students of color, and feeling unsupported. Part of that is not having enough faculty of color at institutions. At most institutions, but also in residency. So I've seen people come in residency and say, like, I want to go into academics, I want to do this, I want to do that. And the work that they want to do, which may be in diversity, maybe not, it maybe isn't valued as highly as someone else's work. But also, like, by the end of residency, they're just completely burnt out. And they're like, you know what, I think I'm done. I think I'm going to go, I'm going to take a private job. I'm going to make a lot of money and just sort of be done with it. Not to say you can't, I mean, some people might need that and they can come back to academics, although it's rare. But I also think we need to make the environment of both undergraduate medical education and graduate medical education more welcoming for people who would like to go into academics.
What do you think we can do to ensure that our medical school programs are providing an unconscious bias in education and training? For example, most of my standardized patients have been white, if not all of them. So how could we, as medical students or pre-meds, encourage the medical curriculum to incorporate training with diversity?
So it sounds like you have to look at things. So there's two angles to look at. There's training of the medical folks, so medical students, residents, et cetera, in unconscious bias training. And then there's training the standardized patients, because you have to ensure that those standardized patients are going to grade students all the same way and can't have their biases be introduced as they're grading patients, for, you know, grading you guys for things like, you know, graduation OSCEs and, you know, OSCEs for your medicine rotation, your PEDS rotation. So there's two things to look at. And one of the things I will say that Rutgers New Jersey Medical School does really well is that they've already implemented that for both. So the standardized patients have to go through bias training, because that's just something the school implemented because they insist on it. And we've been fortunate in that our medical student population, you know, is a little, I mean, it's not, we're still not where I would love to see a medical school population be in terms of diversity, but we're a lot closer than a lot of other places. For the student side of it, all of our medical students actually get through all 4 years a thread called health equities and social justice, where they learn about those social determinants of health. They get unconscious bias training through their 4 years of medical school. So they're being hit with it. And it's interesting because I've sat in some of the small groups and you can see some of those moments of discomfort where people are getting tripped up and they're just kind of like, ooh, should I have said that? Oh, is that the right thing to say? And it's good for them to have those experiences earlier rather than later. So I think that's something the school has done very well, but I think you have to train from both sides. It can't be just one side or the other. It has to be both, you know, the students, residents, faculty, et cetera, at the medical school level, but then our standardized patients who are going to be grading you, and not just in the schools, but also I would say at the NBME, because you guys take that little, you know, step two CS, you know, or if you're in osteopathic school, then you're taking the level two physical exam. You know, that's really important to ensure that you guys are being fairly graded the way you need to be graded. So I think it has to come from both sides.
I'll say as far as the curriculum, because there's been a couple questions about, you know, putting stuff like this in curriculum, implicit bias training for places that don't have it. I would remember, so first of all, again, similar to what was said before, don't lose your spot in medical school necessarily by being an activist. I mean, I think there's a level to everything. But the group of you as a class are consumers, and you are paying a lot of money to this institution to get a medical education. If that medical education does not include things that are extremely important to your education to be an effective physician in the future, then you as a group, whether that's your AMSA chapter, whether that's your SNMA chapter, whether that's multiple different student groups as a whole, can go to that curriculum committee and say, this is something that you need to provide. You know, whether that's through the various reviews you might do for the various classes, or again, formally through a committee, you can demand a more equitable treatment. Dr. Bell put a document together from Penn, it's actually where I went to medical school, and has a long tradition from the SNMA and the Latino Medical Student Association who have really pushed the administration to continue to include some things. And there's been some backlash, but there's strength in numbers. And if you can organize around these things, you can actually see significant changes in the curriculum.
I can give an example. So I found this document in the course of the University of Virginia's students who had a town hall with the dean of the whole school and the dean of curriculum, where they were talking about potential changes to curriculum to introduce more diversity and unconscious bias training and make it something that was a part of the curriculum that you did not have the option to opt out of. They were met with some pushback about straining the curriculum and making people potentially uncomfortable, and people may not want to have that training and blah, 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 blah. But the students came back and basically said, that's not acceptable. My discomfort is daily, and it's important for us to be culturally competent and capable physicians in order to deliver high quality healthcare. That is an absolute requirement. If we want to graduate from the University of Virginia, that should be a requirement to attain that degree, to go through this sort of training. So they asked for another meeting with the dean to discuss this issue specifically, because they gave the message that the first answer wasn't good enough, and they're going to have this meeting coming up next week. So they're using guidance from this document to inform their talking points for the meeting and looking to get this put into the curriculum.
I'm not sure that bias training is the most effective way to do this. I'm just going to say it out loud, because I've seen it at least at the attending level. I think, health equity and all of those things, they definitely need to be integrated into the medical education, undergraduate medical education and graduate medical education. But bias training, it has been shown to like last for like the effects last for like a couple days where people are like, oh, and then it's like, yeah, and I'm going to now revert back to the implicit bias that's been built for, you know, however long they've been alive, you know, and by the time you finish your medical training, you are, you know, in your 30s, maybe, I don't know, late 20s, early 30s. And these things are in you because we're part of this society. And so I, for one, I love data. I'm like a little bit of a data geek, and I'm on the data action team at University of Virginia for the Department of Emergency Medicine. But I believe in like discretion mediation. Like, do not take away all of the discretion, because obviously as clinicians, we need that. Like, we need to be like nuanced in our care of patients. But I'll give you one example of like what I call discretion mediation. Don't try to Google it, because it doesn't actually exist as a term. But for COVID-19, we noticed in the emergency department that there was a disparity in testing for patients who came in for COVID. And so the question, we noticed, because I asked the question. If I had not asked the question, it would have never even come on to anyone's radar, right? So ask the questions. Because I'm the physician lead on the data action team, was easily able to access the answer to that question and found that, okay, our suspicions are true. And so what we did was I worked with leadership, who also was like, oh, that's a real problem. Worked with leadership to say, okay, we have a screening process. So if you screen positive based on your symptoms, you are a person of interest or a person under investigation, and you come back and we treat you in a different area and so on and so forth. Until we rule you out for COVID, rule you in for COVID. So of the people who were screening positive, white patients were more likely to be tested, and Black patients were more likely to be like taken off of COVID precautions and not tested at all. And of the people who were screening negative, white patients were more likely to be tested, and Black patients were not being tested nearly at the same rate, even if they screen negative. So to get down to the root of that, what we have now is, one, we added some social sort of vulnerable populations. So if anyone is a person of color, specifically if anyone's Black or Hispanic, or if you live in communal living environments like jail, if you're homeless, or if you're literally living in a home where you can't like socially isolate, we added that to the screening process so that more people, we would capture a little bit more of the vulnerability there. And then on the flip side, when a provider, usually a resident, goes to order a test, if the patient is screened positive for symptoms and positive for these additional factors that we added in, it takes them to a screen. It's a BPA, it alerts them, it says this patient is positive, it takes them to the test. It makes it very easy for them to order the test. And if they say, no, actually, I'm not going to order that test, you have to pick from a small list of why you don't order the test, right? And then the same thing for the patients who are screening negative, who then the provider says, actually, I am going to order a test on this like white female who screened negative and also doesn't have any risk factors. It does the same thing when you go to order the test. It says, like, it doesn't seem like this patient is high risk. Why are you ordering the test? And it's a short list. And some of those, you know, might have good reason to order the test, but it helps us to better understand why people are taking the actions that they're taking. And it helps to mediate any bias, right? And so we've actually seen a change in that. The numbers are starting to level out a little bit more. We don't have equal populations of like Black and white and everything else. So we expect there will be some differences based on like who shows up at the front door. But we've seen some success with that as well. So I think hitting this with multiple different areas in multiple different ways. But I like discretion mediation. Although as physicians, we don't really love it when people take control out of our hands. But I'm like, take it away, take the bias away. Also, so.
I give control to you, Dr. Webb, any day.
Yes, you also have given me a lot of PPE throughout this pandemic, which I'm very grateful for.
Exactly. So I know we're over time, but I wanted to point out one thing that Dr. Webb said. It was asking the question and how important that is. So how refreshing and potentially game-changing would it have been if COVID starts and from the get-go, our leaders, both in the hospital level, the government level, are asking, how is this affecting our underserved population, our Black and Brown communities, our Latinx communities, our populations that we know experience adverse health outcomes? And then we're looking at this data proactively and asking these questions proactively, so we don't get to weeks and weeks down the road after thousands of people have lost their lives. We can actually think about these problems in real time as they evolve. there's a viral pandemic that causes disproportionate outcomes, both in screening and in mortality and morbidity, and disproportionate death that disproportionately affects Black and Brown communities. It is called influenza. It happens every single year. And we have the same disparities that play out, a different virus with the same outcome, and it happens year after year. And it's so baked into our medical lexicon that we just expect it every winter, but this is what plays out. And we need to ask those questions too. If we have a view through a racial equity lens, we ask these questions proactively. We're looking at this data and we're asking people like Dr. Webb, you know, how are we testing in the emergency room? How are our ambulatory visits? Are we having any disproportionate outcomes when it comes to screening, testing, isolating? That's what needs to change about healthcare delivery going forward. This needs to be an anti-racist approach to delivering better healthcare. That means actively ask the question, find the solution, but more importantly, be comfortable talking about these issues.
I'm blown away. I had maybe like 15 questions to ask you guys, but I think we only got to like three of them. And I think just stands to show that this is not just one conversation that we can have. This is definitely a series of events that I think as future physicians, as med students, as pre-meds, that we can definitely benefit from, especially when it comes to what can we do to change the policies to ensure that people of color, Black and Brown communities can get the fair treatment and the quality care that they deserve. I know there's so many questions in the comment box that haven't been answered yet, but I do want to thank the panelists for their time that they've given us this evening. It's opened my eyes to a couple of different things, especially the social determinants of health and with different bills that are in the House right now or in the Senate that we can go ahead and call our Congress person to support. That's something definitely that AMHSA can do, and I'm pretty sure we can send out an email with the call script to everyone on this call if you're interested in doing that. I think from the discussion as medical students, we can feel safe to talk to one another about racism. Someone mentioned that, you know, let's not lose our spot in med school. So I think that's important as well. Advocacy has its time and place. And I think we are at a better start than before because we really had no idea what to do at this time.
Can I say one more thing, Ebony? Sorry, I talked too much. Sorry, it's your fault for inviting me. I wanted to end this conversation on like sort of a call to action note. I know you already talked about voting and doing all those things, and I think that's really important. My husband is an expert in health policy. I fully support that. But like change starts with you. And so if you choose to change by voting, that is fine, but it also starts at home. And I think medical students in particular often feel like they don't have a voice. But you do have a voice. You do have a voice. You have agency. You need to sort of look at this as like, look at your time, your treasures, your talents, and see what you can do to help fix the problem. You guys don't have a lot of treasure right now. I get that. You also don't have a lot of time, but you are all full of talent, full of talent. Like, I fully believe that you guys can change the world, just like I think that kids are sort of what's going to take us from this vicious cycle to a more virtuous one. But like, you can do it. Like, you all have what's in you, and you're not sort of in the sort of cycle of the full cycle of medicine yet. Like, you can make these changes. So I encourage all of you to dig deeper and really find your voice and your safe spot and your advocacy spot, and go out there and use it. Find like-minded people. It doesn't mean like losing your spot in medical school or standing up to that, you know, one racist attending or resident. Like, I'm not saying that. I don't want you to lose your spot either, but find what you can do, because if we all do our part, then collectively we really can make an impact on society and on medicine, and specifically like take good care of the patients that you see, and make sure that your colleagues are taking good quality care of your patients as well, because it's really what it's about, right? Patients first.
So to close us out, thank you again to everyone for participating. Special shout out to Ebony for moderating such a wonderful panel and putting together so many important questions. We will be just taking a copy of the chat box, and we'll ask our panelists just to answer any questions that they feel strongly about answering or anything like that just afterwards. And we'll also send out that call-in script that Ebony was mentioning as well. But we'll be having more of these AMHSA activism updates. We'll be having more conversations like these throughout the year. And I don't know how to end this. But thank you. Thanks to everyone.